We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. Today we are coming to you from the annual Harry Potter Academic Conference at Chestnut Hill College, where we'll be discussing Potter in difficult times and the best hope we have. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2, and co-editor of Potterversity, Essays Exploring the World of Harry Potter.
And I am Emily Strand, director of campus ministry and humanities faculty at Ohio Dominican University, and a contributor and co-editor with Katie on those things that she mentioned.
In this episode, we are going to discuss our experience at the Harry Potter Academic Conference at Chestnut Hill College, which just wrapped up moments ago and which was completely digital this year, DigiHPAC, as they called it. There were so many fascinating presentations from all over the world. And so, Emily, for our warm-up question, I just thought I would ask you, what is one takeaway that you collected from this year's conference? Just the one.
That's a tough one because there really were a whole lot of insights.
Yeah.
This Molesworth business that Mitchell educated us about was hilarious. That's probably on like the kind of hilarious end of the spectrum, but the plenary address by Elliot, and somebody help me with Elliot's last name, Borenstein?
Borenstein.
Yes. Borenstein. His talk
also was hilarious.
Also hilarious, but also kind of more in a, I don't know, like a darker way that like I was constantly having to challenge myself to say like, this is the reaction of some people, like not all people from this particular country. Like this, like I was constantly having to sort of identify like this is, I don't want to like kind of assign certain stereotypes to people of all one country. I mean, that's just really dangerous.
And he was talking about Russian approaches, like fan culture around Harry Potter and like uses of it in a variety of political ways, particularly.
Right.
So yeah, that was super, super interesting.
Right.
Yeah.
We'll get into all of it. So those are things. So what about you, Katie? Are you ruminating on a particular thing?
Yeah, I'm just going to give you a holistic answer because it's such a big question. Instead of singling one thing out, I was just really caught by the idea that there is still so much to say about Harry Potter and its impact and the fan culture and all of the different iterations of it. We just still have a lot to say. I laughed, I cried, I was angered, I was inspired. You know, it was all things. Maybe not to all people, but definitely to me.
So, I got up at lunch and went to a protest.
Yeah, right.
Katie, should we take a minute before we get into the question? Should we take a minute just to introduce all of our guests, or maybe let
Emily,
all of our guests?
I always do that.
I know.
After the warm-up question.
I'm sorry. Okay.
So in this episode, we are joined in our discussion by some Potter scholars and regular attendees and presenters to the conference. And I'm just going to name everyone without long introductions, and I hope that's okay, but feel free to talk about when you, when you identify yourself, talk about anything that you've particularly got up and coming or what have you. So I'm just going to do them in alphabetical order. So first we have John Dunn, Louise Freeman, Lori Kim, Mark Anthony Lewis, Mitchell Parks, and I put her last because she is our Potterversity producer, Lori Beckoff, who is also the communications coordinator of the conference. Welcome back to the show, everyone. And I can't wait to hear your thoughts about how Potter relates to our current moment, not only in the United States, but in the wider world as well, which I think the international quality of the conference really emphasized. So I think Emily, you are set to ask the first question, and I was going to give a go at it. So.
Yes. I crafted this question with you in mind, Katie, because you always have such good explanations of these historical realities, these terms. But this word, fascism, which I am still learning to spell, is getting thrown around a lot these days. I mean, at my house, when the evening news is on, there are always people muttering about fascism, in reaction to the news. So what do we, and I think, different people probably mean different things, but in a kind of a historically accurate way, what do we really mean when we use this word? And I pose it to Katie, but then, we can open it up to other
Yes,
people's
and
thoughts
I'll
too.
start out, but I'm just going to show this won't be on the but I, these were my notes about what is fascism. So I'm not going to do all of that.
A whole handwritten
Right,
page.
Laurie's expression on that was classic, but I thought I could start it off. The thing about fascism is that it is really ideologically complex and it develops historically. Mussolini does offer a definition of it that I usually have my class read, and then we spend a whole class period like decoding what is he talking about. People use it wrong all the time, but historically speaking, fascism is a hyper-nationalist movement. It's like nationalism with modern media and technology and on steroids. So it's intensely nationalistic. And so it can be really distinctive in different countries because different countries have different national identities. And that's why it can sometimes be a little tricky to identify. But often when I'm having my students talk about Mussolini's definition, I have us talk about it in terms of what it's against, because that's how it's framed, and what it's for as a result. So Mussolini makes it very clear, and this is also the various other fascists are all in line with this as well, that it is fascism is anti-democratic. So it is anti-liberty in that way. It is anti-socialist and anti-communist. And this is one of the things people get wrong a lot today. Fascism rose as a movement directly in opposition to communism because Mussolini came to believe that was a weak and womanish kind of position that people should all have material security. And so it is anti-equality as a result. It was also anti-feminist, anti-pacifist, and anti-internationalist, right? So it's nationalist, so it's anti-internationalist. It is pro-military and militant in itself, and that's its anti-pacifist. It is very masculine in the way that it sort of presents like a really actually very retrospective idea of what masculinity is. And so it's anti-feminist and it is anti-socialist, communist, and anti-democratic. And so it is pro-dictatorship, where the leader becomes the embodiment of the nation and the national spirit. And so you often see fascists are very, they're very much about national unity. They're very much about obedience. They're about military expansion, aggression. They believe in the superiority of the particular country. And they are statist in the sense that the state is supposed to encompass every aspect of life. And I thought I saw this a lot in the Harry Potter papers today. So it controls media, it controls culture, it controls schooling, it controls, I mean, they're not really elections, right, in a fascist state. It's controlling all aspects of government. In terms of the economy, it controls the economy, but it does so in league with big business. That's corporatism, the idea that big business and government are allied together in that way. And so that's just my very brief version of it. It's very modern ideology, though, because it relies on technologies like surveillance and also propaganda and censorship that are really key to making it work. So I don't know if other people would like to weigh in on that as well. Anything that I left out? I was trying to think especially of the things that come through Harry Potter, but Mitchell.
Can I jump in on Latin stuff? Mussolini, of course, was way into the ancient Romans, as one might gather. The word fascism itself comes from the Latin word fasces, which is a ritual item. It's a bundle of sticks with an axe head in it as well, that the ritual bodyguard slash attendants of certain Roman magistrates carried around as a symbol of power. And the particular power that it symbolized was those magistrates' ability, not in the city of Rome itself, where they're supposed to be civilians, but outside the city of Rome on the battlefield to have the power of life and death over any Roman soldier in the military, right? Which, again, is against normal functioning of society. People have trials and things. But outside the city, they had the power of life and death. And that power is called imperium, which is what we get the imperious curse from. So that's that kind of idea of total control over somebody gets directly in through the Latin to Harry Potter.
And imperialism is a key aspect there too. Yes, often. So now I will know how to pronounce Fasces. And that ancient Roman connection is very nationalistic for Mussolini, right? The strength of old Roman Empire.
And I appreciate, Melanie, you spelling fascism for me in the chat. Can you please come into my classroom and just whisper things to me? Because yes, I can't spell anything in my classroom correctly.
This is why I do handouts, Emily, because you can't, it's hard to spell on the board.
Like,
who wants to be a millionaire up there with all the lights and lasers and stuff? I think Mark Anthony had something to weigh in on this as well.
I wanted to ask you, and can you guys hear me? Just want to make sure.
Yes.
Okay, right. I wanted to ask you, Katie, actually, as someone who's not an expert on anything and also spells fascism incorrectly all the time, I wanted to ask you, I know race and racial purity is kind of a part of fascism in some ways. And I know Mussolini originally thought that racism was silly until his cool friend got into it. And so he kind of adopted that that idea.
So here's the thing about that, because this is how different nationalisms can affect fascism differently. So in Germany, like that idea of nationalism was more of a genetic as well as like linguistic folk idea. But Italy really didn't have that. We think of Italian people as one people, but they were super diverse. I'm sure that Mitchell could tell us some things about this too. And they didn't even all speak. In fact, most of them didn't even speak Italian at the beginning of unification in the 1860s. So that unity has to be created. But Mussolini is a little more expansive. If you are Italian and you share in the aims of, you know, Italian nationalism, particularly focused on its history and Catholicism and a shared vision of the future, then you can kind of be admitted into that. The racial exclusion is distinctive of, I think, German fascism or Nazism, although not to say that other fascisms don't also come to use that as well. But historically speaking, that's how I would explain it. I'm going to go ahead and ask the second question that we had on our list, which is going to direct us more toward the Harry Potter books themselves. The encroachment of fascism in the wizarding world is gradual in the Potter books, as it often is in the Muggle world. Although I guess it's a little speeded up, right? Because it's only 7 years in the Potter books. And maybe it's, I don't know, I'm challenging my own question now. It seems slow, and then all of a sudden, boom, you're fascist. Okay. The encroachment of fascism is gradual. Where do we see the first instances of authoritarian creep in the story? Do you think, like, how far back does this tendency toward fascism go, really? Lori?
So I was having a think on this, and I think the main thing we always think of is Book 5. Order of the Phoenix, there's like very obvious, definite fascism happening there. We're getting overreach into the school system. We're having government corruption. It feels clear there. But I was thinking, how much further back can we go? I think we start to see a little bit in Goblet of Fire with the way that Traverse of Torn was being run. Government corruption is starting there. I think it's even stronger starting out in Prisoner of Azkaban with how Sirius is handled and the way that they can just put, you know, the secret police or whatever you want to call the Dementors, like stationed by a school, and that's acceptable and can be done, you know, despite the feelings of staff, students, and parents. And then, of course, the way Sirius's innocence is handled or not handled. But I think we can go even further back and say Chamber of Secrets, because that's the first time I think we really see meddling at Hogwarts and putting Hagrid in Azkaban without a trial, deposing Dumbledore, from which they say that's, you know, that's from the board of directors of the school. That's not technically the government doing it. Even Fudge is not necessarily on board with that. But I definitely think the ministry getting involved there and arresting Hagrid purely on suspicion is the first instance we start to get.
You're making me think of Marjolaine Martin's piece on the prison system, which you do get this, you know, this little snapshot of that in Chamber of Secrets.
I also was looking at Lucius Malfoy and the board of directors deposing Dumbledore in Chamber of Secrets as an early instance. Mm-hmm. And while I guess the board of directors is not technically a part of the government or the federal government. I don't know what you would call the Ministry of Magic, but I guess they'd be kind of a federal government. But Lucius Malfoy himself is definitely a representative of a wealthy elite class of people. And he is exerting his influence over the board of directors. I think he says that he threatened to curse them or something, so that he could get rid of an educator or a political rival that he didn't like, because he didn't like his ideals. So I think you could definitely say that. The earliest thing I could think of in the series as a whole is the treatment of the post Voldemort troubles, part one, you know, after Harry gets rid of Voldemort, and we see the not just Crouch going around and, you know, arresting whoever he could arrest, or the kind of the kangaroo courts that they had, but I would say the lack of responsibility, or the lack of proper reconstruction after that. It reminds me a lot of the lack of reconstruction in America after the Civil War, or it reminded me a lot of something like Operation Paperclip in the United States, where after World War II, we hired on a bunch of Nazi scientists because they were valuable to us. And it made me think there's lots of people like Lucius Malfoy who pretended to be under the Imperius curse, but because he was wealthy, they just kind of ignored it and let it slide. And the lack of holding anyone responsible, really, and just kind of brushing everything under the rug.
Yeah, I do think we can see that there's some kind of deep-rooted like vulnerabilities to fascism, if not outright signs of it. Emily?
I was thinking about that in the talk on journalism, which I so right. enjoyed, and the kind of weakness of the Wizarding World's journalism outlets being that there just aren't very many and they're not very diverse. And so that does leave the society vulnerable. I also just want to say, since I'm in charge of the chat, all of you people in the chat are our guests on this episode too. So thank you so much. Lana Whitehead says, possible mention of Grindelwald in book one as a, you know, an early hint. Melanie agrees with the arrest of Hagrid in book two on no evidence at all. Dementors in schools is making MJ think of ICE at schools. For sure. Marjolaine says that she's always thinking of the statute of secrecy being often used as a good excuse for authoritarian politics in the Wizarding World. That's really, really true. Yeah. And that underlies, you know, the series really from the start.
And the Wizarding World from the start is built on a principle of fear and secrecy, which is
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A lot of great comments in the chat.
Yeah, I see Louise has a comment too.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up too. I mean, when you look at that, the other minister chapter, which is very funny in its own way, but also, you know, like a lot of Harry Potter, has that dark side. I mean, you can see that, you know, for a long time, the wizard world, at least their attitude towards the muggle world, is, well, we know best. We're going to walk into the prime minister's office and make sure, you know, he or she presumably does what we want, and, you know, just to make sure, you know who we're really in charge. We're the there's not only this shadow society within your own society, but there's this shadow government, and you know you will cooperate with us, and you have no choice.
Yeah, from that wider muggle view, you know, the fact that you've got these powerful wizards who could assert power over you at any time,
and a prime minister who is scared to tell anyone, you know, you're not going to tell anyone this. We know that because no one's going to believe you. So you just need to suck it up and just do as we say.
I have a question about how we are defining fascism in the Wizarding World. Since Katie, you brought up that fascism is inherently nationalistic. Do we see that in the Wizarding World? Are we defining the nation of Wizarding Britain as opposed to Muggle Britain? Or do we see evidence of Wizarding Britain having any kind of national attitude compared to other Wizarding nations, other than like the competition of the Triwizard Tournament and the Quidditch World Cup, which is like basic friendly competition for the most part. So where does that nationalism fall into place here?
I think there's kind of an interesting going back to what Katie and I were talking about, where I guess fascism kind of takes a different shape depending on the nation, with Wizarding Britain, we're kind of seeing a nationalistic, I don't know what word to use, racial, I guess, identity with Wizarding Britain in terms of Voldemort's rule is wizard first above muggle, in pure blood above wizard. And I think it is very Britain focused as well. We noticed that there's a Dumbledore intentionally tries to bring in people from other countries, wizards from other countries into the fold, because he sees that there's strength there. And I think we don't really see that with Voldemort at all. He's very Britain focused in his rule. And
there's,
we don't really
Karkaroff though, right?
Sort of. He's there. He's for a little while.
Yeah, I think you're right in terms of the racial identification, especially with all the pure blood language. And, you know, to note that, and it is, I think it has possibility for internationalism, but we don't really see that so much from Voldemort. He's sort of his own entity, you know, and he represents what, you know, wizard power, and that all wizards should you know, obey, as a way for wizards to be strong in general.
Yeah, I want to read Rhea's comment here in the chat. They said, I think the nationalism lies in the ideology believed by the antagonist Voldemort, where the main enemies or Jews are the Muggles. Yeah, therefore they are to be eliminated. The main aim might be developing a new world for the wizards who would follow the ultimate ruler Voldemort.
Right, or enslaved. I mean, the Nazis wanted to enslave Polish people, for example, to make them slave labor for the, and, you know, work until death or something like that, right? So the idea of, you know, having slave labor forces, which I think is how they view Muggles in that statue in the Voldemort Ministry of Magic, which I think echoes a lot of those things intentionally. Like, I definitely think those are intentional nods to aspects of Nazi Germany, particularly.
The Tolkien lover in me is always wanting to say, you know, it doesn't have to be an exact fit, too. I mean, you know, to shed a lot of light and to shed a lot of insight into our present times and into previous historical realities to really kind of inspire and illuminate. So
yeah. So our next question has to do with the development and progress of fascism, and whether we see it unfolding in the wizarding world in phases, and if those are identifiable, and what we might glean from the progress or the progressive development of authoritarianism in the wizarding world that could help us today. What are your thoughts on that? I see Mitchell. Yeah.
I want to jump back to something Mark Anthony was saying a little while ago about the 1980s and that interwar period, with Barty Crouch Sr. and the creation of a security state, right, among the wizarding community in a reaction to Voldemort, right? So it's an anti-Voldemort security state, but it leads to the conditions where it makes total sense once the ministry is taken over by Voldemort that they can start othering people in order to further the needs of that security state and make it look like just another move in the same direction, even though it was the other party, which I have in air quotes here, who kind of started that process in the first place. Very similar to things that we might see in our own country regarding the last several presidential administrations' use of executive orders, right? They're all kind of creeping forward in terms of executive authority to the point where you get the cascade where we found ourselves now.
And alliance with big business, I think, also, no matter what the party. Other thoughts on the progress? John Anthony? Yeah.
I don't know about like phases, but I just think about book five does have a kind of distinctive sort of like gaslighting denialism kind of flavor that I can't help but find plenty of comparisons to present situations in the States. And I sort of feel like we've been stuck in book five for the last decade or so, you know, in American history. And the kind of constant, like nothing to see here sort of vibe is, you know, unsettling. And it's, yeah, reflective, I think, a lot of the kind of feelings that especially Harry has in Order of the Phoenix.
Yeah, I've sometimes relayed my kid was reading Harry Potter books when he was 9, so he's 18 now, so perfect your decade there. And he said to me, "I feel like we're in Harry Potter book 5." And I was like, "Oh, Dumbledore's army still recruiting." Lori, what do you think?
Yeah, I looked at the question phases and what we can identify and head off in our situation. Some of it's too late. Some of it we have progressed beyond what they have happening in Order of the Phoenix. One thing that I've been thinking about a lot, though, is there's what I call the Cassandra lag, where there are some people who know exactly what's going to happen. And in the Harry Potter series, it's Hermione. She sees exactly what's going to happen, and then other people saying, "Oh, come on." Harry and Ron, when they're younger, don't believe it's going to be that bad. And then there comes a point when people don't want to believe it because it's too frightening. And eventually, when times come for you, you have to face it. And that will be a time when, when it hits home, when you have to pay double your health insurance premium, then, oh, wait, me too. So that's something that I see in the series that we can prepare for is what happens when it hits home for people. Expect the lag, accept them when they come, which we see with Dumbledore telling Snape, "Come to my office at the 11th hour. Yes, you've been an asshole your entire life. You can still come." Or Percy, who is very nearly unforgivable and just says, "Well, it's been building for a long time." Percy, it's not that he just came to it overnight. He couldn't deny it anymore. And then when he could, he made a break for it. Or Ron with the Deluminator. So that's something that I think we can focus on. When they come back, accept them.
Yeah, David Martin had a comment in one of the sessions where he said, we really have to be able to ally with people we don't agree with on everything, to be as inclusive as we can in our resistance. And I was thinking also about in the keynote, Elliot Borenstein was talking about Harry Potter in Putin's Russia. And so my question was like the degree to which popular culture can help to thwart authoritarian creep or to overdo it. And he made, I think, an important comment that relates to Lori, your idea that sometimes it's too late. And he basically said that. He says, well, once the state gets to a certain point and it's a, willingness to use horrible violence and oppression, then some of the cheekiness is not really going to get you anywhere. But then I sort of think about the people in the animal costumes, and this was in another talk. I think Maria Matsakis's talk, that there's something about being in community, even if it doesn't really seem to have measurable impact. Maybe those, that kind of Potter Watch, and Dumbledore's army and those little organizations that are underground or counter to the, the state control of culture and organization, that can actually be helpful to us, even if we don't see the immediate impact. So I was really inspired by what he said there. Emily.
Yeah, I just wanted to pile onto that. In Maria's talk, I made a comment about, I mean, she was listing all these wonderful things we can do, and I made a comment about podcasting. I mean, podcasting is a really important space. And I've heard a recent study. I'm going to have trouble giving you a full citation to it, but I heard a recent study that kind of surveyed all these podcasts for like both explicit and implicit political messages. So a lot of times it was not an explicitly political podcast. It was just like, the bros talking. And yet what was being said was highly conservative, hyper-masculine commentary that, flagged it as more conservative. And so like something like 70%, 70% of the content out there in the podcasting world is more conservative. And so I always like all of us are just barely fitting all this in, in these podcasts. I have another podcast that I'm also not fitting in very well with my life now. But I keep saying to myself, I cannot give these up. I cannot give these up because I feel like these are so important to come into this space with a progressive message because it's sorely needed in this particular space. So.
Yeah, Lori Kim also has a podcast where they basically going through Harry Potter again after 2020 in a way that I think is really valuable and that people want to hear and listen to.
This makes me think of Maria Matsakis's paper from earlier today, where she talked a lot about organizing and how we can, you know, fight fascism within our own fan communities and taking, you know, a page out of Dumbledore's Armies book. But the way you were just talking about it, Emily, makes me think of like, not just now, how do we resist, but how is fascism enabled by the culture that is created like online and in our media, that it goes both ways, right? Of like, you have a fascist dictator who makes it okay for people to say certain things that would never have been acceptable for people to do certain things and get away with them. But also, does someone like that get into power because there's already a culture brewing where people think those kinds of things are acceptable? And I'm thinking about like, if anyone has examples that comes to mind, that come to mind in Harry Potter of, I mean, the fact that Draco Malfoy never gets in trouble for calling Hermione a slur. He like shouts out in the middle of school and there's no detention. No one thinks to like go like tell Snape or McGonagall or anyone like someone's yelling slurs in the hallway. And so I wonder what other examples people have in Harry Potter of where that culture is allowed to persist before we go full fascist.
Yeah, and I didn't know if Lori Kim had something that she wanted to say about the podcast that she's doing.
Yeah, I was actually going to answer a different question with that, but I'll plug my podcast, Harry Potter After 2020. It's in many ways just another chapter reread podcast. We do a chapter a week, and we're currently, the next one is going to be called, is the Detention with Dolores chapter. And my co-host, JC, is a professor of education in Texas. So especially when we have entered into Order of the Phoenix, a lot of the government interference in education and rewriting and punishment of academics is something that she's actually dealing with all the time. We originally started it saying, okay, the purpose is to compare our reread in the current climate to how we felt when we originally read the series in prior times. And it's been dark, but fascinating. And, you know, and part of the problem is the author and her turn to the right, which is part of the of a larger trend. So,
yeah, I mean, and I think a lot of us here are educators in one way or another. And I just saw a lot in the chat about, you know, educators trying to deal with our current moment and still trying to, you know, to teach critical thinking and independent thinking and like true things. I always say, I'm just going to teach true things. And I hope I don't get doxxed or fired for that.
There is a lot of really cool stuff going on in the chat right now. Haley Reed, who gave this great presentation about Harry Potter's like an orphan dreamscape earlier today, talking about the whole point of the series is about letting those in your inner circle inspire and encourage you, and then being able to take that love and acceptance and spreading it throughout society. Marjolaine is talking about her job at the Ministry of Justice in France and seeing politics slipping into areas where it did not used to have a hold, how to resist from within. That is a big theme with me in many ways, resisting from within, and talking about how fascism is actually enabled by cancel culture, which is really, you know, cancel culture has become this like, you know, contested phrase where we have kind of both sides of this, you know, using it as a dirty word, but at the same time, this idea of any kind of censorship really limiting all of our freedom is a very difficult concept to navigate, you know, in the face of like Lori, what you were just talking about with like people, you know, giving slurs in the hallway, you know, spreading slurs in the hallway is like, how do we live in a society where we have to permit free speech and yet at the same time we have to encourage civility? How do we do that? So there's just a lot of really cool stuff in the chat. I wanted to give it a shout out.
You know, as historians, like our solution to this is usually just good argument and good faith argument, with the idea that the better argument will win. And I don't know it in our current media landscape that's necessarily true. And I just want to kind of go back to, I think Louise made the point about the media outlets and the fact that the Daily Prophet doesn't seem to really have much competition in the wizarding world. And look at the way that we have had the concentration of media into just a few hands here in the United States, and how vulnerable then that makes that to state takeover.
Melanie is asking in the chat, and I don't want to make this about J.K. Rowling because I'm just not as interested in her, but she said something about, did J.K.R. turn to the right about everything or just transgender issues? I mean, frankly, Melanie, I have a theory that she was always far more to the right than anyone ever really realized, and we had just kind of done this, what's the word that... the Monsters author uses, that parasocial, we were in this parasocial relationship with her where we just thought that we just liked her so much in her stories that we just assumed that she believed about things the way we believe about things. And, you know, I don't think that was ever true. And I think that this transgender issue has been a lens with which we have come to this realization that she is, does not hold the same worldview as many of us who love her books do. So. That's my theory. Well, I was just going to ask, because Mark Anthony said that you found discussing Harry Potter outside of this community to be tiresome and repetitive, but you value this community even more because of it. You want to say more about that?
I am from New England. I live in a city in New England. And I work at Brown University. I am involved in a lot of progressive groups. So a lot of the people that I spend my time around are progressive people, and they are not necessarily tapped into the recent dialogue happening in Harry Potter studies. So generally, anytime it comes up that I go to a Harry Potter conference every year, or that I have an encyclopedic knowledge of the most useless information possible, or that I've written papers, or that I've got an essay in a wonderful collection of essays called Potterversity, the discussion always becomes, well, what are your feelings on J.K. Rowling? How do you think, what do you think about this? What do you think about her, the things she said about trans people? And I have friends who are trans. I have a friend who's coming out now. We've known each other for a while, so they know that I am not transphobic, and that enjoying a book series about a British boy who defeats Wizard Hitler doesn't make me transphobic. But the dialogue always comes back to that. And I always have to defend myself and say, like, I don't support J.K. Rowling. I think that she is doing something that I think a lot of people who spend too much time on social media do, that they get wrapped up in their small bubbles and they go off the deep end and start, there's a feedback loop where they start, I'm trying to think of people to compare it to, but someone like Kanye West, who has his own mental illness, but he's also someone who's kind of built himself up to, I'm trying not to use the phrase high in his own supply, but I guess that's something I could kind of say about J.K. Rowling and about someone like Kanye West, and that it's nice to be able to come to communities like this and talk to people like everyone here and be able to have a discussion that's deeper than, am I transphobic because I like this book series that I grew up with?
I tried to tell somebody that I was like actively uninterested in what she had to say, right? Because I'm doing my own thing with this now. So, you do get, I think we do have a responsibility to say something in some ways, but it was hard in the Potterversity book to actually figure out how we were going to address that. So just to move to the next question that we had there, other novels and fiction franchises have explored the rise of fascism and tyranny. Of course, it provides so much fodder for modern fantasy, sci-fi, dystopian literature. We've, of course, got Star Wars, Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower and Talents, and, you know, all the Hunger Games and like Divergent, like so many that are dealing with these kinds of topics. What do you all think the Potter stories have to contribute that is unique or particularly powerful or useful?
I could bite with
Ben Mitchell. Okay.
Yeah, sure. I love Star Wars, of course, but it's at least in the original trilogy, as the Empire is framed, right? You don't really have much of psychology of the start of evil, right? That's what the prequel trilogy is for. We get that there. In Harry Potter, though, you see the kind of up close and personal effects on Harry and his peers, right? And a lot of the good that Harry does in the novels is so oriented around protecting actual people, protecting his community. Mm-hmm. And it's only from there that kind of the wider good ends up growing. And I think we got a kind of personalization in Harry Potter that we don't necessarily get. Now, again, if you're watching all of Andor, for example, Emily has gestured to her shirt, which may not be visible to podcast listeners later. You know, you'll get more of that psychology, but still, I think that's a useful contribution of Harry Potter.
I like that. It's funny. It's because it's not as epic as something like the Lord of the Rings series. It's more domestic somehow. And that personalized experience and the individuals that you see there, I think is really very useful. Other thoughts on this, what Harry Potter has to offer that's unique? Yes, Lori.
I think that it's about children is one. I mean, you mentioned Divergent, of course, Hunger Games. Those came after the Harry Potter boom. And I think those were influenced by the Harry Potter boom. But having children and teenagers as our main protagonists fighting this, and also the fact that we see them growing up as the fascism is happening. So it's something else where, like, Luke Skywalker is only supposed to be like 18 anyway. And there are other young protagonists and things that start out dystopian, such as the Hunger Games. And so I think it's interesting to see children growing up in this scenario and this unfolding before their eyes, not children who were born into a fascist dictatorship, children who think they live in a free place that starts to become more and more fascistic as they grow up, and how they respond to that when we already know them as younger characters, not living under that.
How do you respond in that moment when it's not already a calcified system, but when it's a system that's dynamically headed toward authoritarianism? Yeah, Mark Anthony?
If I could add to what Laurie said, I think particularly because the Harry Potter series takes place over teen years, there's kind of a disillusionment that happens over the course of the series, where you start out with Harry being young and it's very whimsical and magical. But then as he gets older, there's a disillusionment where he realizes that there's not just an evil on the rise, there was an evil that was always there. And he's starting to recognize the flaws that always existed. For myself, anyway, I don't know about everyone else, but as an American, we're kind of seeing that there's problems that have existed for a very long time, and we're just kind of seeing them come to a boil now.
And he literally gets the disillusionment charm in book five, right? So I always felt like that was a signal. Yes, Louise, do you want to weigh in on this question? What's
okay,
unique
yeah.
that Harry Potter offers?
Sure. What I was going to say is, you know, as the mother of kind of a first generation Harry Potter readers, you know, my kids, you know, went from Harry Potter pretty much straight into Hunger Games, Divergent, some of those really popular dystopian YA series of that time, you know, late 2000s, early 2010s. What was interesting, and I think this was a talk at this conference several years ago, when talking about how about midway through, again with book five, you know, the Harry Potter series could be considered to move sort of, as Mark Anthony said, from this more fantasy series to more of a dystopia, where there's this actively evil government that our hero has to struggle against. You know, I think Harry Potter set the stage for young people to enjoy that type of dystopian fiction and relate to it, because they saw, you know, Harry go from that earlier stage to the maybe these slightly more mature books. And I thought it was fascinating to hear Lana talk about putting on the Hunger Games pin in her classes this year when she was asked not to discuss politics with her college students and how that symbol is still there, you know, 25 years after the Hunger Games series. Yeah, I think that's part of what Potter gave, you know, at least a generation of students who are now in their college to post-college years, the, you know, 20s, early 30s, starting their families, that generation that's going to be probably most severely affected, more so than some of us 60-somethings or close to 60-somethings, by, you know, what's going on in our world today.
Yeah. And so I want to move on now to the next question, which I think we actually got a fair amount of in this conference as well, which are, you know, the idea of solidarity in opposition to violent oppression, that it's an important bulwark against fascism. And this is one of the things we love best about the Potter stories. And so what are some of our favorite moments or elements of the stories? And this for you in the chat, you know, give us some of your favorite moments or elements of the stories that you think bolster community and can translate into real world resistance that we can also emulate. Yeah, John?
I really, you know, going back to the idea of we've kind of been living in Book Five for a while. I really love the Sorting Hat's new song, "In Order of the Phoenix." I love Lana Whited's talk
yes.
on that this conference. And what I particularly love about that the song is, you know, in the midst of this kind of like uprising of this authoritarian regime, the Sorting Hat's like, I shouldn't be doing this. I don't know why I'm doing this. And I as the Sorting Hat kind of retells this history, what I really love is how it kind of focuses on the teaching philosophy of the four founders and, you know, calls Hufflepuff good. Says, good Hufflepuff, something like, I'll take the lot and teach them all the same, something like that. I'll teach everybody everything, you know? And I think she's the only one who gets any kind of title or, you know, adjective. Everyone else is just called by their names. There's something about her teaching philosophy that I think, like, meets the moment, you know? And I feel like, I guess the vibe I think of building community, you know, kind of like the growing the allyship comment that was made earlier. I really think we need to not be sorting hats in this moment and, you know, further perpetuate the polarization. And we need to be Hufflepuffs and egalitarian and really, and I'm a Ravenclaw to be clear, but I just really think that the vibe of Hufflepuffs is what we need in this moment.
Lori Kim.
So, yeah, I saved up my comments to answer this question because I made myself stop at 9 from the series that I think have practical applications now. One of my absolute favorite things from this series is when Harry, Hermione, and Ron take turns wearing the Horcrux. He doesn't have to wear it alone.
Mm.
It's a lesson for allies. First of all, when you put on the Horcrux, that tells you how bad you feel during those 8 hours out of 24. That's how that friend of yours feels all the time. So this is a barrier that goes down between the friends is, are you really my friend? Are you actually willing to feel, to know how bad I feel all the time? This is what I've lived with. And it relieves some of this burden. So that's an ally thing to do. Note, you know, when there are people in the current regime that suffer more than you, speak up, take some of the burden off, and understand how much burden that puts on somebody daily.
I love that because it's not you know, purely joyful, but it offers relief in a really crucial way, relief for suffering.
The second one is I love in Order of the Phoenix when Ron and Hermione are fighting and Harry is so sick of it and he snaps at them both. And then Ron takes him aside and is very gentle and says, look, Hermione and I have talked to each other. We've stopped fighting, but you have to stop snapping at us. This is actually, you can see this within fandom discussions against people who still like Harry Potter too. Yeah, you can have infighting, but don't fight more against your allies or your imperfect allies than against the actual enemy. You're going to need the allies. The third one is know that your more privileged friends have to come to things in their own time. You cannot ask people to risk their lives only out of loyalty or love for you or duty. That it's the stakes are too high. It's not going to hold. Know that Ron is going to have to go away and choose it for himself and come back himself because it's the first time that his parents and his siblings have been almost killed. Until now, the stakes were not so high. He could do it on love and loyalty and reason. But when it gets that personal, your friends have to choose it for themselves. That's going to be the strength that lets them do the actual fighting. The fourth thing is it's okay to not say Voldemort's name, even though Dumbledore said. You have to learn from Snape, who says that the dark arts are ever changing, and you have to be flexible also to try to stay a step ahead. If the circumstances change, don't be so dogmatic that you put yourself at risk. Knit some hats. Even if it doesn't actually do anything, that's, when you think about the absolute energy that Hermione discharged into making every hat in the world, it'll actually make you feel better. And that is part of the message of resistance, is just do nice things for other people. The sixth thing is, there is a moment when Harry is obsessed about the Hallows because he thinks that it might help him survive to get the Hallows. And it's sick. He knows it's sick. He's obsessed. It's like when he was in front of the mirror of Erised. He's not sure, what does Dumbledore mean? Should he even be alive? And then he remembers at the end of staying up all night that Luna is stuck in a basement. And then he's slightly ashamed of himself, but it snaps him back. So there are times when your things are so dark and you might lose hope, especially if with poverty or unemployment, that's, not going to get better anytime soon. If you worry about your own survival, that might not be enough to keep yourself focused. But if you think that there are people that you want to protect or love or encourage, and you talk to them and you remind them of the value you see in them, that can help focus you. That's an actual strategy that I think people can prescribe for ourselves as, as the grimmest exercise. Like, well, I don't know if I'm going to survive another day, but you'd better survive. And this is why. Know that tyrants are in bad faith when they demand concessions as though they're negotiating with you. There's that moment when Pansy Parkinson wonders, what is wrong with us? He's saying hand over Harry Potter. Harry's right there. Why isn't anyone doing the obvious thing? And nobody even bothers to argue with her. They just look at her and McGonagall makes her leave. What Harry knew already in the Department of Mysteries in the Battle of Dalahof, he has almost killed Hermione and he can't talk right now, but he's pointing to Harry and says, I'm going to do the same thing to you unless you give me the prophecy. And Harry laughs in his face and says, oh yeah, like you're not going to just kill me as soon as I hand over the prophecy. So, universities, when your funding is threatened and they tell you that they will give you $500 million if only you'll cut some departments, what are you, stupid? No, don't. No. It's not going to work. The only way out is to say, we're not falling for that. Sorry, I got a little political.
Preach.
Yeah, I don't work for a university, so I can say this kind of thing. The eighth thing is when Bellatrix says to Harry, I've just crucioed Neville, and if you don't give me the prophecy, I'm going to do it again. And Harry is just about to hand it over. Plot happens so he doesn't, but he has zero qualms about this. It's instant. He doesn't care. Nothing matters as much. So if there is a billionaire insisting that for some reason it's really important to throw trans rights under the bus, don't believe it. Choose our trans loved ones and selves and family and friends without hesitation. The ninth thing is, make it a practice to stay in touch with your magic because that's what's going to keep you sane. Find the things, remember the things that make you feel the most like you and do those. For Harry, that's flying. No matter how crappy his life is, when he flies, he feels himself again. Voldemort can't touch that. It has nothing to do with Voldemort. That's something that is him. For Snape, it's brewing, because I wondered when I first read this series, he's under so much pressure. How can he stand it? Oh, he goes on about the softly simmering cauldron. He's in a flow state. He loves this. Okay. Find that thing, make it a practice because that's what's going to keep you centered during the fight. if there are people trying to tell you that you're less than, that you don't deserve to live, that you don't deserve to be happy or to take up space, they're trying to keep you from that. Claiming that and being with it is the way to triumph over that. I now mute myself.
That was wonderful.
That was awesome. That was
Oh,
an avalanche of awesomeness.
yeah, I mean, I think of things that you know, are those moments of connection and where they're together in groups, but I love how you know, you picked out these really key moments that are often quite individual. I thought that was really great for reflecting, you know, as the Patrick McCauley was talking about how personal an interior reading is. And that sense of, you know, what am I as an individual going to do now, and how should I approach this? That was really cool. You know, our last question was, can fiction really help fight oppression? And I hope that we basically know that, like, we're basically saying yes, right? That it's giving us a little bit of a blueprint. It's giving us community. It's giving us a language through which to talk about these things. Yeah, Louise.
Well, I would say if it couldn't, no one would ever be trying to ban it.
Yes. Yes, Louise.
That's
Yes.
it. Exactly.
Yes.
Right on.
Yeah.
Right on.
It is
Well,
great.
thank you all so much for joining us today on this special episode of Potterversity from DigiHPAC 2025. And thank you to our guests, Lori Beckoff, John Dunn, Louise Freeman, Lori Kim, Mark Anthony Lewis, and Mitchell Parks. And so I'm going to leave you all today. Our quote that we used for our title comes from a scene in The Deathly Hallows where Remus Lupin reveals that the last thing Dumbledore said to him and Kingsley Shacklebolt was, "Harry is the best hope we have, trust him." And so that sort of, we were thinking about Harry Potter giving us hope. And I hope that that is something that you've come away with from the conference and from our podcast. I certainly feel more hopeful from my experience these last 2 days. But I wanted to leave with a quote that I often think about in regard to HPAC, but especially this year, given how international the conference was. And this is from Book 4 at the beginning of the Triwizard Tournament, when Dumbledore says to the assembled students from Hogwarts, Durmstrang, and Beauxbatons, "Differences of habit and language are nothing at all if our aims are identical and our hearts are open." Thanks to everyone for a great conference. Until next time, class dismissed.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The show is produced by Laurie Beckoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsbernd, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsbernd. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.